going from theory to practice in analyzing legislation from a biblical and constitutional perspective. Next on Principles and Policies. Hello, this is Chuck Michaelis. I'm the Vice Chairman of the Institute for Principled Policy, and I'm also the Executive Director of Camp American. Well, last week we told you that we were going to attempt to do a show on something that's going on out in the Dayton area regarding our Institute on the Constitution classes, and we were not quite able to get that story put together the way we wanted to. So a lot of the people weren't available for interviews this week. I think a lot of people are on vacation. So what we've done is we have gone ahead and put together the class from Camp American, the second part of the class that we played last week. And I think you'll find this a very interesting class in that Barry Sheets taught this class. And last week we did the first part where he gave the theory on analyzing legislation from a biblical and constitutional perspective. And we think that the practical knowledge of that would also do you well. And so what we have here is the audio portion of a class that he taught on that subject, in which he shows the students how to analyze a bill. And we think that you may find that useful. So many of you really are interested in the process, but don't know exactly how it works, the legislative process. And this is what Barry is doing here. He's giving you a look-see into how bills are written and how they are interpreted. So on that basis, I'm going to turn it over to Barry so that he can get started and give you the knowledge that you need to understand what's going on in a bill. So without further ado, here's Barry Sheets with Analyzing Legislation from a Biblical and Constitutional Perspective, the Practical. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, this morning you're going to get the rest of what we started last night. This morning it's going to be a little different, I believe, in that this is going to be more workshop style. So in other words, if you don't have your booklet, you kind of need it. And in lieu of anything else, any other announcements, here's Mr. Sheets.
Good morning, campers. Oh boy, we got some feedback. I think that came from my phone because I've got a call coming in. It figures right at the time you got something going on, you get a phone call. One reminder, please turn off or put on stun your personal devices here so that we don't have the interruption in class. I appreciate that. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, this morning we are going to be looking at applying some of the frameworks that we talked about last night on a piece of legislation. Now, if everybody will get out their camp books and turn to page 47. Also, did everybody bring their pocket copy of the Constitution? Do we have those? If you don't have one, find somebody who does and share, because we will do a little exercise with that as well. Okay. All right. Well, what we're going to do today is we're going to take a look at a bill. Now, this bill is fairly short. It's 6 pages long. It is one that actually has been introduced in the Ohio General Assembly this year by some of the members in the House. And it hasn't gone through the committee process yet, but it likely will have some hearings probably before the end of this year. So this is kind of a way to get folks ready to be able to understand what's going on in a bill. But first, as you see, you take a look at the first page, you see a lot of things happening on the front page of a bill. And so what we want to do, and again, this is going to be interactive, so I'm going to walk you through basically some of the introductory material. I'll give you some of a general overview of what's going on when you look at a piece of legislation so that you know what you're dealing with. And then we're going to go through and we're going to break down the bill in sections, and I'm going to point out to you what's happening in there. And hopefully, if you were taking notes last night, you might be able to tell me some of the things that you see from some of the frameworks we talked about. Yes. Okay, we have a mic up here, so raise your hand and Mr. Michaels will get the mic over to you. Okay, so when you're taking a look at a piece of legislation, there's a few things you need to know to start off with. And these are, no matter what piece of legislation you look at, whatever state you're in, you know, whether you're in Ohio, Indiana, Kentucky, Michigan, whatever it might be, all legislation is going to have a handful of items in common which are going to give you some general information. Some of these include, and we'll start off with the first thing, when the bill is active in the legislature. If you notice here, it's this little section right here that tells you the 128th General Assembly regular session 2009-2010. So you know that this is a bill. This isn't something that was done in the previous assembly. This isn't something that's being drafted for the next assembly. It's active right now. So that you need to know that when you grab a piece of legislation, because sometimes members will reintroduce the same legislation session after session after session. And if you get a hold of the wrong copy, you may not get the information that's in the current piece of legislation. Number two is going to show you which chamber the bill originates in and the number assigned to the bill. Now, where is that on this? Anybody got an idea where that occurs? Hannah? Top right-hand corner, what does it say there? Okay, HB. In Ohio, the convention H stands for House. So we have a House and a Senate. So if it was a Senate bill, it would be SB such and such. And the 496 is just the numbering, and they number bills in sequential order by as the members file them with the clerk's office, and they get into the stream of the legislative process. So we know that this bill is a House bill that originates there, and 496, we have a two-year session, and there's usually in the House somewhere around 600 bills, 600 to 700 bills introduced. So this one has come fairly late in the session. We can tell that by the number. If it said House Bill 1, well, that's the first bill that's introduced, and that's usually the budget, or if the governor is of the same party as a member of the House or Senate, it's usually their priority pieces of legislation. Now, we also have to look at the current status of the bill. And where would we find that at? Basically, it tells where in the process the bill is. Where do we find that on this bill? Yes, ma'am. And your name is? Amy. Amy? Okay, where do you think that is? In the middle of the page. You mean right in here? No, not quite. Where it tells you where the current status of the bill is, where it is in the process, is right up at the very top. You see, this says, as introduced. That means this bill has just been put into the stream. It may have been assigned to a committee, but no action has been taken on it yet. Once it comes out of a committee, it'll say, as passed by whatever committee, or if it goes to the floor of the chamber, as passed by the House of Representatives, etc., or if it's over in the other body by that point, as passed by Senate, such and such committee, or as passed by the Senate. And when it gets through the final process, it'll say, as enacted, which means it's now a law because it's gone through the process, it's gotten the required majorities from both chambers, it's been sent to the governor, the executive agent, and they've either signed it or let it go into law without their signature. So that's how you tell where in the process a piece of legislation is right at the very top. You also find the sponsor and the co-sponsor information. Where do we see that at in the bill? Okay, Max. Uh-huh. Then it says Representative George. Yes, that list. Usually the first name is the member who actually sponsored the legislation. And what they do is when they write up a bill that they want to have introduced, they'll send around a memo to their colleagues in the chamber and saying, hey, I'm doing this and it's a great thing and this is what it's going to do. Would you sign on and help me out? And so they'll get members who will call back their offices or drop an email and say, yeah, put my name on the bill. And that's what the co-sponsor list is. So this one has 1, 2, 3 co-sponsors with the primary sponsor. Now, this also helps you determine the strength of the support, whether it's a bipartisan piece of legislation or not. Now, you know, in Ohio, there's 99 members in the Ohio House of Representatives. We've got 4 members who've signed on to this bill up front. Does it have a lot of strength of support right now? No, it doesn't. It's fairly obvious. 4 out of 99 is 5% of the House. Bipartisan. Well, you can't tell from here unless you know which party these members are. These are all Republican members of the House, okay? So there are no Democrats on this particular piece of legislation. So there's no bipartisan support right now as the bill stands just in its raw form. And then we have a short title of the legislation and what it proposes to do. Where's that at? Amy? Where's that at? It's right there. That's that middle section you were talking about. That's the short title. You know, it's 12 lines long for a 6-page bill. And basically the title, first of all, it says a bill. So we know that there are different types of policy that can be put forth. There are bills, which are standing the regular legislation that goes through the regular process. And there are resolutions. Now, a resolution just expresses the sense or the feel of the chamber or of the legislature on an issue. It's usually, if something the feds do, then they'll pass a resolution of the House saying we support cap and trade or we oppose mandatory health care. You know, they're just basically issuing their sense of the body to something that's pending in another level of government, usually the federal level. Or it's an honorary resolution. You know, the House recognizes Joe Smith for being the best apple producer in the state of Ohio and winning national awards. You know, those kind of things. But when it's a bill, that means it's going to have an impact. It's going to change the statutes of the state of Ohio if it's enacted, or of any other state. So that's the big difference between bills and resolutions, is one actually has an impact on statute, the other one doesn't. So this bill basically says, you know, we're going to assert the state's claim of sovereignty pursuant to the 10th Amendment of the United States Constitution. And if you've got your pocket constitutions, you might as well go ahead and open them up to the 10th Amendment, because we're going to look at that here in a little bit. To require Ohio residents to remit federal taxes to the treasurer of state, to require that those taxes be retained by the state for its own use to the extent the General Assembly finds that the federal government penalized the state for failing to comply with a federal mandate determined by the General Assembly to be unconstitutional, or to the extent directed by a statewide ballot initiative, and to declare an emergency. That's all one sentence, okay? Remember what I told you about that long title I had up here last night? That's sort of what bill language is all about. It tells you what it's going to do, but it tells you in such a way that by the time you get down to the end of it, you've forgotten exactly what this bill is supposed to do. So that's the reason why we need to break down the bill itself. And so what we're going to do is we're going to take a look at this. And we're going to have a lot. I hope everybody's awake this morning, because we're going to do a lot of reading out loud. I'm going to probably just go around the room, because we've got a lot of sections of this, because we're going to read the whole bill in class this morning, because I want you, there are certain things in each of the sections of this bill that we need to focus on as we go. Now, the body has significant information besides saying what it proposes to do that's important in understanding. Now, if you look down on the left hand, as you're looking at it, it'd be the right hand side of the page, you see a bunch of numbers running down the side of the page. And you're going to see that on every page of the bill, a number of numbers running down. Now, those are the line numbering conventions. That is mainly useful when you get this bill into a committee and somebody moves to make an amendment on the bill where they want to add a word or strike out some language or they want to add a section. They have to do it by saying, well, you know, in line such and such, change this to this, remove this language, add this, so that you can go and look at the section really quickly and see where things are going to. Other than that, these line numbers really have no meaning, and they don't become a part of statute. They're just a convention to make it easier for, as the bill is moving through the process and actions start being taken on it, to understand where those things are going to apply when somebody brings an amendment on it. Okay. If you look down here, it says, be it enacted by the General Assembly of the State of Ohio. Okay? So that's their statement of, this is what we're going to do. We want to enact this bill. We want to get this bill into the current law. And it will also lay out the particulars of the changes to the statute. If you notice, there's Section 1, and later on we're going to see a Section 2. The Section 1 is basically the body of the bill. Section 2 is usually any kind of legislative intent information or special clauses that will not become part of statute, but will be something that takes place during the bill's process. So what we're going to do is we're going to start there reading section 1, just this first lines there, 14 through 19. I'll ask for volunteer to kick off, and then we'll start going around the room. Who wants to volunteer to be the first one to read? Okay. All right, we're going to start going around the room. Faith Rose, will you start us off there? Start with section 1 there on line 14 and read through line. It goes to the second page. Oops, let's see here. Line 25. Faith Rose. We'll probably just go around the room as we go here.
Section 1. That sections 131.70 and 131.71 of the revised code be enacted to read as follows. Section 131.70A, the General Assembly finds and declares as follows. 1. The 10th Amendment to the United States Constitution states as follows. The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution nor prohibited by it to the states are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. The General Assembly finds that the 10th Amendment to the United States Constitution defines the total scope of the federal government's power as being not specifically stated in the United States Constitution and no more.
Okay. So that's the opening salvo of the bill. They're kind of laying out the philosophical reason for why they're bringing the bill forward. There are a couple things we wanted to point out in this, and if we look here, we have to understand how to look at bill language. There we go. Okay. We have to understand how to look at bill language because we have to figure out what's being done in the bill, and there are keys to it just from the way it's structured. Now, if you'll look here, you'll see in this bill, there's a lot of language. As a matter of fact, pretty much all of the language in this bill has an underline. Now, an underline means it's new language. It's new wording that's going to be added to the statute. As a matter of fact, it's going to be creating a statute because if you remember back in 7, we have that word enacted. And if you remember from last night, one of the four purposes of a bill is to enact new language into statute. So that's what this bill is going to do. It's not amending a current statute, and it's not repealing language that's already in the code books. It's going to be putting in new language in place. Now, if some of this language had to strike through it, in other words, instead of underlined, they were shot through as a strike through, that means that that's language in current law that's being repealed by the bill. Now, you don't have it in this bill, but you would see it as a strike. You know, basically, they had the word shall up here. You know, they had some wording here and some wording here, but they had a strike-through line through the word shall. That means that they were removing the word shall from current statute in that section. And then if you have regular wording, let's say instead of what you have in the bill with everything underlined and nothing strike-through, let's just say they had a portion of the section where all the wording, we shall overcome, and it was just in regular font and regular type within the body of the bill, that's current law. That language is already in statute, but they have to reprint it into the bill because something in the bill is adding to that language. That you may see that maybe 15 lines of this straight type, and then you have one word that's underlined in that section. That means they're just adding a word to an existing section. But in order for you to understand what's going on in the bill, when you're a legislator or a constituent and you're looking at the bill, they have to put the rest of the statute that's being affected. So that's the reason why some bills can be 2,000 and 3,000 pages long, because if you're saying we're going to add one word to 15 different sections of the code, and some of those sections happen to be like 80 pages long in small print, when you print it in a bill, it's like 300 or 400 pages. But all you're doing is you're adding one word here and one word here and one word here and one word here. You know, oftentimes maybe it could be that you're just adding a certain type or class of citizenry who a current section of statute applies to. Let's say we had a law that said that all chiropractors had to take 12 years of education before they could operate. Now we're going to extend it to say all chiropractors and massage therapists, but the current statute didn't say that, so we have to add the words and massage therapists. But there may be 80 different portions of the code where it deals with licensure issues. So they have to put it in every section and reprint every existing section in the bill so you can see what this one little change of adding one group to it does to the whole body of the statutes that address the issue in question. So that's part of the way you can read a book. So if you get a big bill, you know, you're looking at somebody says, hey, I need you to look this over and the thing's, you know, 200 pages long. Don't stress, because really all you have to look for are strike-throughs and underlines. That'll tell you, and then you can see, okay, 15, I got a page here, page here, page here. Oh, okay, and here's this subsection of this statute. There's one word underlined. Okay, all right, so they're adding it, and then you can walk back through it and figure out if you need to read the other 14 pages worth of existing statute in order to get the gist of it. Usually you don't. So it's really not all that difficult. Okay, we're going to continue on. And I'm sorry, is Emily? Okay, Emily, if you could read there on lines 26 through 30, subsection 2, on the second page. Lines 26 through 30.
2. The Congress of the United States has the power to lay and collect taxes pursuant only to Clause 1 of Section 8 of Article 1 of the United States Constitution, Clause 4 of Section 9 of Article 1 of the United States Constitution, and the 16th Amendment to the United States Constitution.
Okay, everybody get out your pocket constitutions. I want to have somebody look up Article 1, Clause 1, Section 8, Article 1. Let's see here. Does anybody want to volunteer that hasn't already read or done anything yet? Okay, boy, I'll tell you what, we're going to need to get them some calisthenics at flag raising. Okay, Hannah, you'd answered the question. I want to see if I can get some of the other students to go. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1 of the United States Constitution. Who's got it? Going once, going twice. Isaac! Oh! Isaac, go ahead and pull it open there. Article 1, Section 8, Clause Number 1.
The Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises, to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. But all duties, imposts, and excises shall be uniform throughout the United States.
Okay, very good. Well, that's Clause 1 of Article 1, Section 8. So basically, the state legislature is saying, okay, yeah, we grant that that's an enumerated power. Okay, we also have Clause 4, Section 9 of Article 1. Who's got a constitution out? Natalie, would you grab that? Article 1, Section 9, Clause 4. Yes? Okay, well, if you all have this citizen's rule book, that's going to be on page 39. Okay, thank you. I appreciate that. But that's going to be on page 39 of these little citizen's rule books. If you have a different version of the Constitution, a different booklet, that's fine. I've got two or three up here. I did have. I'm not sure where I put them. They're here somewhere. But Natalie, have you got that Article 1, Section 9, Clause Number 4?
No capitation or other direct tax shall be laid unless in proportion to the census or enumeration herein before directed to be taken.
Okay, so that's another area where the federal government has the ability to lay and collect taxes. But it's a restricted ability, okay? And then we're going to be looking at the 16th Amendment to the Constitution. And those are back on the back portions of your booklet. On page 55, Article 16 of the 16th Amendment to the Constitution. Who's got that? Okay, Max, go ahead. Yeah, let Mr. Michaels get the microphone over to you. And I got to keep track.
The Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes on incomes from whatever source derived without apportionment among the several states and without regard to any census or enumeration.
Okay. So the 16th Amendment actually modified Article 2, Section, or Article 1, Section 9, Clause 4. So under the 16th Amendment to the Constitution, they don't have to worry about in regard to census or enumeration. They can tax incomes and do it without specific apportionment from the states. So it makes this language of this bill a little interesting at this point. We'll think about that because that gets to something we talked about yesterday, and we'll get there. Okay, Devin, I think you were next. I want you to read that subsection 3, lines 31 through 34 of the bill on page 48 of your booklet, I believe. Mine has an extra blank page in the middle of it, so if anybody got one of the booklets that actually has blank pages between the two, you can use that to take your notes on. Okay, Devin, if you'll read that subsection 3 there.
The federal government does not have the power to withhold from the states benefits of those taxes by use of federal mandates that are outside the scope of the powers enumerated in the United States Constitution.
Okay, very good. Now, if you'll pass the microphone to Natalie, and Natalie, if you'll read subsection B there, the next thing, 35 through 38.
In the light of the continuing unconstitutional federal mandates that withhold the benefits of these taxes, the state of Ohio hereby reasserts its claim of sovereignty pursuant to the 10th Amendment to the United States Constitution.
Okay, this is a particularly special bill because most bills don't do this, but this is what's called taking the gloves off. This is the Ohio legislature basically saying, we've had enough. And they're putting this forward. If you look at that, what they're doing is they're laying out, number one, okay, these are the powers the federal government does have, and we appreciate that and we recognize that. But then they're saying these are the powers that the federal governments are taking that they don't have constitutional warrant for. And so therefore, under the 10th Amendment of the United States Constitution, everybody turn to your 10th Amendment. Under the 10th Amendment of the United States Constitution, they are going to make a change to the current situation, or the proposed change to the current situation. All right, who's got the 10th Amendment ready to go? Your first name is? Stephen. Stephen, please. Yeah, it's pass Stephen the mic, and it's on page 51 of your citizen rule books. Toward the bottom, Article 10. If you will read that, please.
The power is not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, or reserved to the states respectively, or to the people.
Okay. Is that fairly clear to everybody? If the Constitution doesn't specifically spell out that the federal government can do it, or that the states can't do it, the states automatically are able to do it. And that's the hinge, the linchpin of what the state of Ohio is doing with this particular bill. Now, again, what we've done now in that first section, that 131.70, is they laid out the case. Now that they've laid out the case adequately enough, and where else do we remember in history where a body of representatives laid out a case for the reasons why they're taking an action? A very famous one. This is another softball. Come on, guys. Hannah? The Declaration of Independence. Yeah, 27 articles about what was wrong and why they needed to separate from Great Britain. This bill is laying out some articles about what's wrong with the relationship between the state and the federal government. So we're going to go ahead and take a look there at Section 131.71. But that subsection B of 131.70 is the claim that they're going to base their action on, that the federal government has done continuing unconstitutional things such as put mandates on the states and withholding the benefit of the taxes that the state is paying to the federal government, and they're going to reassert their sovereignty. Yeah, Max, you have a question?
Yeah, numbers 131.70 and 131.71.
Yes.
Those
numbers reference existing sections of the Ohio Revised Code, which is a book of statutes. Section 1, if you I should have gone back. I thank you very much. I didn't do this. When you look at that number, the first number, 1, is the title In other words, there's Title I, Title III, Title V. They're all odd numbers in the Ohio Code. Title I deals with the general operations of government. Title III deals with, I believe, townships. Title V deals with municipalities. Title VII deals with other particulars. But you can find a list online of the Ohio Revised Code and what each title... So this is the general government title, is Title I. Now, it's Title I, Section 31, because there are other... Obviously, there's other... And Section 31 is already existing. There's already other language there. But they're adding a new section, 131.70. So probably the last section in Title I, Section 31, is .69. So they're just bringing the next section in there as new language. And that's how you read that. So this could say, and you're going to see some later in the bill, there's going to be a reference to, I think, 5747 point something or other. That's Title 57, Section 47, subclause point whatever of the existing code. So that's how you read those numbers. Thank you. I forgot to put that in there, so I appreciate you bringing that up. Okay, let's go ahead and move on, and let's start reading 131.71. Daniel, you've got the microphone over there? Yeah, pass the mic up to Daniel, because I want to start there. Daniel, if you'll read lines 39 through 41, you've got a real easy assignment. Just read, starting at line 39 to line 41.
Section 131.71. As used in this section, person has the same meaning as in section 5701.01 of the revised code.
Okay, right there. Now, Max, it gets back to your question. See, that's referencing another existing section of the code, but since they're not changing that section that's in existing code, they didn't have to put all that language in here. So they just reference it by number. So this is the definition section of the bill. So they have to define, for purposes of this particular statute, when they use certain terms, what specific meanings they have, because those meanings may be different as that term is used in other sections of the statute. So for this particular section they're putting in, it has a particular meaning, which is the same as another section of code that already exists. So they link to it so that if you go, you could go to that section of the code, read what the definition of person was there, and it means the same thing for this bill. So definitions are important because if they bring new statute and they don't define it, then if there are more than one definition already of a particular term of legislation in the statutes, then it ends up being the court's decision on how to determine which one applies. So they have to be very careful and define their terms carefully. It's just like anything else, in any type of debate or anything else that you ever get into, define your terms carefully up front. That way there's no confusion about what you're saying. And that's what the General Assembly is doing here. So basically, as I mentioned, that wouldn't apply to the whole body of the statutes, just the address language, because they're creating a brand new section and then creating a definition for this brand new section. So when they use the next... We're going to go, Max, if you'll read lines 42 through 44.
2. Ohio resident means all of the following. A resident as defined in section 5747.01 of the revised code.
Okay, so there we basically, right now, they're basically applying this definition, which obviously is they're going to define it as something that's already defined in code, so they're linking back to something that already exists in law. But now, and Joella, if you'll grab the next section, lines 45 through 46, they're now adding particulars to the definition.
An employer located in Ohio required to withhold federal income tax under subtitle C of Title 26 under state's code.
Okay, so there's a new definition of what a resident of Ohio is. Okay, Heather, will you read 47 through 49?
A person whose primary place of business is located in Ohio and that is required to pay a tax imposed by Title 26 United States Code.
Okay, and I'm going to stop right here for a second because you remember earlier what Max read, that Ohio resident means all of the following. So all of these have to apply for you to fit in as the definition of an Ohio resident. Or each one of these sections would apply one way or the other. So you could be a person who has a business in Ohio and you're an employer and you're a resident. Those can all apply, but in this section, the way it's written out, they each can apply individually. So I could be a resident, as defined earlier, or I'm an employer who I have a location in Ohio, which means I'm paying state taxes, or my primary place of business, and I'm required to pay taxes in Ohio. Okay, and then subsection D. Rachel, if you'll do lines 50 through 52.
Any other person located in Ohio required under Title 26 United States Code to withhold or collect a tax and remit it to the Internal Revenue Service?
So basically what they're getting at in this bill is anybody who has to pay federal taxes is defined as a resident or Ohio resident for purposes of the bill. So they're trying to narrow the pot and broaden the pot at the same time so that they make sure they catch everybody who might fall under having to pay taxes to the federal government while they're in the state of Ohio. Okay, Stephanie, take a deep breath. Subsection B, lines 53 through 66.
An Ohio resident that is liable for a tax imposed under Title 26 United States Code shall remit the tax to the Treasurer of State on or before the last day on which the payment may be made without penalty under federal law, and shall include with the payment the person's federal taxpayer identification number. An Ohio resident who fails to comply with this section may be subject to applicable penalties assessed pursuant to federal or state law. Upon receipt of a payment made pursuant to this section, the Treasurer of State shall deposit the payment to the credit of the federal tax fund, which is hereby created in the state treasury, and shall report to the Internal Revenue Service the name and tax identification number of the person from whom the payment was received and the payment amount. The Treasurer of State shall be prescribe the manner in which such remittances shall be made.
That's okay. When you become a doctor, you'll know how to prescribe. Okay, now there are some things going on in this section that we need to unpack a little bit here. Words have meaning, okay? There's a major difference between using the word shall and using the word may. And if you look in this section, the word shall is used 5 times in this subsection. They shall remit the tax. They shall include with the payment. The treasurer shall deposit and shall report and shall prescribe the manner. Shall is directive language. It must be followed and acted upon. It's not optional. If the word says that some actor shall take an action or shall be prohibited from taking an action, that means that there's going to be force behind it. That's the will of the state legislature, and that's going to be enacted upon. Those are things that if it's a shall and it's not done once the law is enacted, then the executive branch can take an action. If it's may, if they use the word may, and those are the only two words they use, shall or may, it's permissive. It will permit the action, but doesn't demand it. So if you don't do it, there's no penalty behind it. There's no sanction behind it. But this, speaking of sanction, this law has an interesting sanction in it. If you look at starting on line 57 after the period, I'm showing you guys how this is how they do it when they do an amendment. Line 57 after the period, starting at the word "and," and traveling through line 59 to the end of the period. An Ohio resident who fails to comply with this section may be subject to applicable penalties assessed pursuant to federal or state law. There's a sanction involved here. If you don't comply with the shalls above, you're putting yourself in a position of being liable for any penalties that both the feds and the state can put on you. So that's a sanction involved in the bill. Now, sanctions are important because if you have shalls and you don't have sanctions, or on the converse, you can have shalls and have rewards with them too. You shall do this, and therefore you will get this. And if you remember, we talked yesterday about that allocation of resources. Oftentimes, shalls with allocation of resources are ways to get people to change their behavior or to do things that the government wants you to do. Shalls with sanctions behind them are ways to get people to do it by force. There's two ways to get people to do things. You can either, and I'm saying this as legislatively, you can either bribe them to do it, or you can put a gun to their head. And that's basically what you do in statute. You either bribe somebody with an appropriation or some special thing that they get if they do the action, or you put a gun to their head and say, well, if you don't do this, then this is what the state's going to do, and now the Fed's going to do it. So we got to be careful. You got to carefully look at where sanctions are in bills as well. So also there's another thing that's happening in this section that you need to think about. If you look at line 61, there's a shall again. It's directive language. That shall references the treasurer of state, who is a state elected official and who's also part of the executive branch of government. He's one of the five statewide offices. So the treasurer has to do something. What does the treasurer have to do in this? This section right here, starting on line 61, what is the treasurer doing? What's the directive language telling him to do? Okay, Max?
The treasurer of state shall deposit the payments to the credit of the federal tax fund.
Whoa, stop right there. Yes, he shall deposit payments. So people are going to remit their federal tax payments to the state treasurer now instead of to the IRS. Now, the treasurer has a duty once he gets those. And remember, if you don't do it as a taxpayer individual, as an Ohio resident is defined under the law, you're applicable for all these potential penalties. Now the treasurer has to, now he's got the money, what does he do with it? He's got to put it in a fund. The federal tax fund doesn't exist in Ohio. Then you look at the, which is hereby created in the state treasury. So this bill now creates a new entity in state government within the office of the treasurer of state called the federal tax fund. So they've created a new fund category for money to be put into. So that's another thing legislation does. And then the treasurer also has, they shall report to the IRS the name and the tax ID of the person, and they shall prescribe the manner in which such remittances shall be made. Now, those are the required actions by the government agent. 10, got it, 10. I think we can get through it in 10. that's the action required by the government agent. What are the sanctions on the government agent in this bill if they don't follow the shalls? Do you see anything in this section? No, you don't, do you? It's unclear as to what would happen if the treasurer just said, no, I'm not going to put it in that fund. No, we're not going to do that. Of course, the treasurer probably wouldn't do that because, remember, they're a statewide elected officer, and if they were to violate a mandate from the legislature of that magnitude, they wouldn't be in office the next time they ran for office. So there's an underlying implied penalty that if you don't do this, you may not hold that office because the public will be upset because you're not doing this, because this is a bill to, as we will read later, to protect the public from the federal government. So there's an implied, there's no actual sanction against the treasurer for not doing it, but the treasurer will do it because to not do it would be foolhardy. So that's where we're going to, okay, so where did we leave off? Okay, Rachel, Stephanie, okay. Name again, please. Stephanie, I guess you mixed up with your sister. Okay, Stephanie, if you will read section line 67 through 71.
Except as otherwise provided in this division, on the last day of each quarter of each fiscal year, the Director of Budget and Management shall disperse to the Internal Revenue Service the amount in the federal tax fund. Before disbursement, the director shall make the following transfers as appropriate.
Okay, now here's an interesting little clause, and this is something you have to look for when you're looking at legislation too. Those little words up front, except as otherwise provided in the division, we call that an exception clause. An exception clause, you need to track back in the language what triggers the exception and what it modifies. So, except as otherwise provided, then so there's an action that the treasurer must, the director of budget management now must take. and they must disperse to the IRS the amount in the federal tax fund. So in other words, treasurer gathers up all this money from the taxpayers, and then the director of the Office of Budget and Management, which is another executive agency branch that handles creating the budgets, then takes it and gives it to the IRS. But the exception clause says that the legislature is saying there are certain circumstances where we don't want that action to happen just as it's written. And then they go and give you the exceptions, because that's the otherwise provided. Now, if they didn't have that in there, and it just said on the last day of each quarter, you could stop at line 71, and subsections 1 and 2 and A, B, and 3, 4, and 5, and, you know, would not be necessary. So this entire, you know, page and a quarter wouldn't be, they wouldn't write it in. But they're going to craft out some exceptions, and these are some interesting exceptions. So let's keep moving on. Starting right over here, Jesse? Let's go ahead and read lines 72 through 75.
From the federal tax funds of the general revenue fund for the use of any purpose for which general revenue fund money may be used, the amount of interest earned on money in the federal tax fund.
Okay, pass the to Amy, and you read lines 76 through 80.
From the federal tax fund to the general revenue fund for use for any purpose for which general revenue fund money may be used. The amount stated in a concurrent resolution adopted during the fiscal quarter, in which the General Assembly makes both of the following determinations.
Okay, if you'll pass over to Emmy, right? Okay. I'm starting to learn names. That's good. If you'll read 81 through 84.
The federal government has imposed a financial penalty on withheld an amount from or denied matching funds or grants to the state as a result of the state's failure to enact legislation or take any other action mandated by the federal law.
And okay. And pass right down. And your name is?
Gwen.
Gwen? Okay, Gwen, if you'll read lines 85 through 87.
The federal law mandating the legislation or other action exceeds the authority granted to the federal government by the United States Constitution.
Okay, we're going to take a little short break. Go ahead and pass it back. We're going to take a little short break here and think about this, because they're basically saying that you will do this except if the General Assembly passes a resolution during the same quarter and determines that, number one, the government's imposed a penalty on us or withheld money from us, or the federal law that mandates the action exceeds their authority under the Constitution. So what they're saying is every quarter the General Assembly is going to take a look at what the feds are doing to them, and they're going to make a determination by passing a concurrent resolution. Concurrent resolution gives the sense or the feel of the legislature to a federal action. This concurrent resolution is actually linked to a state statute now, so when they pass it, it will actually implement or trigger something that this bill is going to put into statute. So, you know, we have another action that the state legislature may take in order to, but they take it on the grounds that the feds are not doing their job or they're doing something tyrannous. So those are the two trigger provisions to kick the resolution. So those two have to apply. Got it. Five. We're going to get there. Okay. Subsection 3. Sorry, who's that back here? Oh, hey, Jacob. Boy, you've changed since last year. Jacob, if you'll read lines 88 through 91.
From the federal tax funds to the general revenue fund for use for any purpose for which general revenue fund money may be used, the amount certified to the director of budget and management pursuant to division of this section.
Okay, pass it over to Wes. Wes, if you'll get lines 92 through 96.
From the general revenue fund to the general tax fund, the amount stated in a concurrent resolution adopted during the fiscal quarter in which the General Assembly finds that some or all of the amounts stated in a resolution adopted under Division C of this section is no longer imposed, withheld, or denied.
Okay. Now, if you take a look at those two sections, one says that, okay, we can take money out of this federal tax fund and put it in the state coffers if the Office of Budget Management does something pursuant to Division G. So G's later on, so we'll read that, and that's triggering language as well. And then also says, well, then we can go from the general to the federal tax fund if the General Assembly passes and says that basically, all right, they're no longer imposing or withholding this, so we got to give that money back to them. So there are triggering things. There's a lot of action that will have to be taken by the legislature. when this bill is enacted. Isaac, you got the big one, 97 through 111.
To be effective, a concurrent resolution adopted under Division C2 or 4 of this section shall be adopted by affirmative vote of 3/5 of the membership of each House, shall state the amount imposed, withheld or denied, or the amount no longer imposed, withheld or denied, and shall be spread upon the journal of each House. Upon adoption of the resolution, the clerk of the House in which the resolution was first introduced shall deliver a copy of the resolution to the Director of Budget and Management. If a resolution is adopted under Division C2, if this section or an amount is certified to the Director of Budget and Management under Division G, if this section and the amount required to be transferred or paid from the federal tax fund is greater than the amount in the federal tax fund, the deficiency shall be carried forward and applied against the future credits to the fund until fully satisfied.
Okay, well, the big point of this whole section, other than where they're shifting the money back and forth and the fact that, you know, if there's more money and less money in the tax fund than what they owe to the federal government, they'll just wait until it builds up and then send more, et cetera, is a particular provision to require more than a simple majority vote. So the legislature actually, in this one, what is it? What's the vote count that they have to get in order to make this section enacted? It's stated, yes.
Three-fifths.
What's that?
Three-fifths.
Three-fifths. Now, in Ohio, there's 99 members in the House, so three-fifths of the legislature, 60 votes. And there's 33 members in the Senate, so that's 20 votes in the Senate. So they have to get... It's not quite a supermajority, but it's not a simple majority either. They have to get a 3/5 vote in each of the two chambers of passing this resolution in order to make it effective. Now, they do that to show that it's significantly supported by the elected officials. And they don't want to have something where just basically a simple majority, you know, if you get some kind of movement, the people are like, well, we got to go do this. Sometimes with a simple majority, they'll make bad decisions. You know, because it's all popular and everybody wants to be liked, and so they'll vote for it. But then afterwards, you realize, well, this didn't work out so well. And if we'd had a larger majority we needed before this passed, we could have taken more time to thought about it, because you'd have to really unpack it and debate and discuss with the members in order to get to those 60 votes. Because 60 is a big threshold, and when you've got 100 members or 99 members of the House, so. All right, let's keep going. Jared? Okay. You want to do lines 112 through 116.
If an event described in Division C2A of this section occurs while the General Assembly is not in regular sessions, the General Assembly will convene in special session pursuant to Section 8 of Article 1, Ohio Constitution, to consider the constitutional issue.
Okay, well, you know, this is something you don't find in most legislation, and that's where the General Assembly is imposing upon themselves the need to go into a special session in order to take some action. Usually, special sessions are only called by the governor, and where he demands the legislature come back and act upon something that he wants. This one is, they're basically putting the restrictions upon themselves. All right, we need to keep hustling along here. So, okay, and your name is?
Brandon.
Brandon, if you can read lines 117 through 129.
By the power of initiative reserved to them under Sections 1A and 1B of Article 2 of the Ohio Constitution, qualified electors of the state pursuant to Chapter 3519 of the Revised Code may propose by initiative petition a law requiring the Director of Budget and Management to transfer from the federal tax fund to the General Revenue Fund in any fiscal year, an amount to be stated in the proposed law, or requiring the Director of a Budget and Management to transfer from the Federal Tax Fund to the General Revenue Fund in any fiscal year, an amount to be stated in the proposed law. If the law is enacted and the amount required to be transferred from the Federal Tax Fund is greater than the amount in the fund, the deficiency shall be carried forward and applied against future credits to the fund until fully satisfied.
Okay, just pass the microphone down. I'm going to go to the next section. Your name is?
Jed?
Okay, Jed, if you'll read lines 130 through 132.
The provisions of this section shall be implemented regardless of any sanctions, mm-hmm. threats, court action, or other pressure brought to bear by federal authorities.
Okay, go ahead and pass the mic. That section right there is basically states saying we're going to assert our sovereignty no matter what the feds try to do to the state. In other words, they're very serious about this legislation. Okay, Nate, right? Okay, Nate, if you'll get subsection G, 133 through 140.
The state shall defend all civil and criminal actions brought against an Ohio resident by the federal government for compliance with this section, shall indemnify the Ohio resident for any tax, civil or criminal penalty or restitution.
Restitution, yes.
Or interest the Ohio resident is forced to pay, and shall compensate the Ohio resident for any economic damages caused by the action, any cost incurred or amount paid by the state pursuant to this section shall be certified to the Director of the Budget and Management.
Okay, very good. Guys, this is the bread and butter section of the bill, subsection G. What is subsection G? We talked about it yesterday. What is this, honestly? Okay, let's see who was paying attention last night. Hannah? Nope, it's not allocation of power. We've got some of that in this bill here, too, because they're allocating power from the feds over taxes to the state. So overall, there is an allocation of power in this bill, and it's going downward. It's not being centralized to the feds. It's coming down out through the state. So, but there's another, this section right here specific. What is it doing? Max? This is definitely interposition. This is the state stepping between the federal government and the taxpayer and basically saying, we're going to indemnify them. You go ahead and sue them and say that they're responsible for all these penalties. We'll pay it. Now, of course, they're going to start paying it out of the federal tax fund. We can make that transfer from the federal tax fund to the general revenue fund for purposes under this section. You remember, this is subsection G, which was referenced back earlier on line 88 through 91, that basically says that from the federal tax under the general revenue fund for use for any purpose which the general revenue fund may be used, and this subsection G is saying we're going to use state dollars to indemnify and protect our citizens against the feds if they try to sue them. The amount certified to the director pursuant to Division G of the section. So these link back and forth. This is interposition. That's what they're doing here. They're basically saying, okay, you state taxpayers, pay it to us, and we'll take care of the issue. Last thing is subsection 2. I'm going to take just about 1 minute because we are running out of time. This is called the emergency clause. Most legislation, when it's enacted and becomes enforceable 90 days after the final action's taken on it. So after it passes both chambers, it goes to the executive agent, the governor. He'll either sign it or let it go into law 10 days without a signature. That's usually how, and then 90 days later, it becomes effective. Emergency clause, which is section 2 of this bill, makes the bill effective and enforceable upon the signature or when that passive enactment period, that 10-day window, has passed. In other words, they want this thing taking effect immediately. So I want you guys, we're out of time, but I want you to, as you go, think about this and look through there, because just about every one of the frameworks that we talked about last night are included somewhere in the frames of this bill. You know, we talked about allocation of powers. There's jurisdictional authority issues in here. Everything we've talked about is in some shape and form in this legislation. And if we had more time, we would have gone back and broke through those particular issues. But it took us a little longer than I expected to read through it. I want to thank you for your attention and your patience. Have one handout that goes along with this. Since we're talking about taxes, we didn't even ask the question of whether or not the income tax is a legitimate tax, both under the constitutional authorities, which we've read in those amendments. It seems that it is. But what is it biblically? And this little article I'm going to hand out talks about taxation, liberty, and the Bible. So I wanted to make sure you guys get one of these before your next class. So thank you very much.
Well, that was a sample of one of the classes that we do at Camp American. So if you're interested in finding out more about Camp American, we did not have it this year, but we're going to have it again next year. We've already set up the dates and the times. So we're all set to go next year. All we need is you. Have a look at our website, www.campamerican.com. That's Camp American with an N. If you go to campamerica.com, you're going to get a camping supply store, which will help you at Camp American, but it won't get you there. So, again, www.campamerican.com. You can buy a video presentation of what you just heard. That will actually help us out at the camp, which we would appreciate very much. It would be a donation to camp. And those videos are available in our web store, which is also available on the sidebar. And we will post a link in this when we link it up. I'm making sure that all the links work. And once I have all the links working, we'll post a link. You'll be able to buy this class on analyzing legislation from a biblical and constitutional perspective. It's a two-part video. The cost will be nominal. You'll have all the PowerPoint slides, and it will be ready to view, ready to go. So, again, we thank you for being with us. Join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.